Listen to KRFP Radio Free Moscow 92.5 on your FM dial, www.krfp.org for folks on the web. It's 4:03, and this is the Wild Clear Water Country.
Well,
it's
cold
weather in the Wild Clear Water Country.
Sometimes around Halloween is the coldest time of year every once in a while, and it... I'm hoping that it's not true this year because I love the cold weather, but one never knows. I remember a few years ago, the coldest time we had all year was right around Halloween. And everything warmed up. I was up on the Selway and it froze over. A really nice trip.
Yeah, I've heard that from some other folks too. Say it's typically can be pretty cold around this early November time of year.
Yeah, in November. Sometimes Thanksgiving's the coldest time of year. So that's really very, very interesting. Well, I've got... So what have we got on the tap today, Will?
Well, we're going to be talking about all kinds of stuff today. We're going to be talking about some interesting, seldom seen creatures in the Clearwater Country.
Okay.
I'm guessing a creature. I'd like to hear from you if you have seen one. How about that?
Okay.
I think a few enough people have seen these guys that call us if you have. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
And if we don't answer, it's not because we don't like it. It's because we're still talking.
That's
so wait
right.
for a musical break. And we're going to be talking about some peaks. We're talking about peaks. New segment.
We're a new segment.
Peaks of the Clearwater.
Peaks of the Clearwater. We're going to talk a little bit about some peaks and kind of travel around the region and talk about some of the different mountains in the Clearwater. So peaks of the Clearwater.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about large mammal interaction down in the Frank Church.
Uh-huh. And we're going to award this week, rather than a Whopper, there's going to be an Elk Burger. Elk Burger this week. Okay.
We're optimists this week.
We are. And I guess we have an announcement, don't we?
Yes. This Friday, 2 days from now, there will be a big annual meeting celebration held by Friends of the Clearwater. It's their annual meeting celebration in Moscow at the 1912 building, 6:30 p.m. And they are, you know, they're celebrating the Friends of the Clearwater, all those folks out there who work hard to keep this place wild. And there'll be live music from, you know, Idaho folk singer-songwriter Brian Gill, big silent auction. It's a potluck dinner, so bring your favorite drink and food and and come and have a good time.
That's right.
Yeah. That should be fun.
Good items. Okay, so it It's one of the announcements. And I guess, of course, the other announcement I think we should make is just to remind everyone on that Tuesday, it is election
day. That's right, next Tuesday. Oh, wow.
Next Tuesday is election day, and that is the November
7th.
7th, that's right, mm-hmm. 7th. I was going to say 8th, but I said, no, that's not right, it's 7th. So that's the election day, so people should be aware of that.
Yeah.
So, well, should we launch right into our show here, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where should we start?
Why don't we talk about that article?
Let's talk about, yeah, and we're going to award us an award here. Do things a little bit in reverse.
Yeah, yeah, we're switching it up. We're making you, our listeners, keep your ears on.
That's right.
Be astute.
Okay. Well, some interesting news from the Associated Press and an interview with the Oregonian. Jim and Holly Akinson, who happen to be the caretakers for the University of Idaho's Wilderness Research Center, which is inside the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness. There's about 65 acres of private land and inholding within the wilderness. It's only accessible by trail, or they also have a landing meadow there. It's a big dog leg. I've been there. I know a little bit about it. In fact, I got to have that job for a winter, Will. As a caretaker,
right.
Before they, Jim and Holly became the permanent ones. I guess they're on permanently now. And prior to that, they were actually there permanently. And for a few years, they changed the policy and had them had caretakers there just for the winter. And I got to be one of those few. But they're doing a lot of research down there on several different species. They're looking at the interactions between large carnivores, wolves, and cougars. I don't know that they're looking at black bear, but those two large carnivores down there, bighorn sheep, elk, and I guess mule deer. They're looking at some of those interactions. And guess what? They're starting to dispel some of the myths. First of all, they're saying that wolves are not responsible for declines of elk. Now, we've seen that before. We've heard that before. And the scientists have said that, but these researchers are also saying the same things. Wolves are not to blame. In fact, they're saying that there's many elk down there as there were before. They're just not as visible. Elk aren't, they're being like real elk. They're behaving like real elk, and because of wolves.
Interesting.
And they've noticed some very interesting behavior of wolves. They've chased elk. Sometimes elk will go for water. Go right into the river, Big Creek, which is a good-sized stream. And a lot of other places, that would be called a river. It's a good-sized stream. Head for there, maybe head for the Middle Fork, who knows. And wolves have a disadvantage in the water. And so that's what elk do. Boom. They get chased. They head for the water. Very interesting strategy, survival strategy. So I find that quite interesting.
And they said they were jumping into some of the lakes down there as well.
The lakes and
escape predation.
Oh, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Also, some interesting interactions between the two big top carnivores down there, lions and wolves. And they relay a story. I think this is interesting that they relay a story where they were riding on one of their mules and he saw, what was it, a dead cougar in the trail. And it was in that narrow part. I took it to mean, when they said way above Big Creek, took it to mean it's probably one of the narrow parts. I'm not sure exactly which part of the trail, if it was on the Big Creek Trail that's 300 feet above the water. I'm not aware of any place that quite fits that description, although I think he may have been on one, either coming down one of the side trails like on Pioneer Creek, or maybe he was also speaking of that very narrow part, that lower section, about 6 miles. Maybe 4 or 5 miles up this really rocky gorge, but it's not, it's very close to the river there, but it's kind of dangerous. They found a dead cougar and heard then wolves howling all around them.
Call the helicopters, call the Forest Service,
exactly.
Get me out of here.
Well, they got a little nervous. He wondered if they'd killed this cougar, but he wasn't worried because of necessarily his safety. They weren't worried about that. They say, it was kind of spooky, but the reason it was spooky was they had animals. He was riding a mule and had a pack string and didn't want to get bucked off the cliff. And that's what was scary about that situation. Not that there were wolves around or this dead cougar around. And he, when he relayed the story, he said his mule, being very, very smart and calm, just stepped right over the dead cougar, and off the pack string went. They did say they do take some precautions. You know, they are careful in wolf country, and people start wondering, oh, what do? Do they carry their guns all the time? You see, they don't let their golden retriever out alone.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're talking about a dog, which is genetically very similar to a wolf. It's not like they're all worried that the wolves are going to get them. That wasn't the scary part. The frightening part is, you know, having the stock animals there, as he said, or having his dog out and having the animals there get spooked and fall off the cliff. But they've taken precautions. So they're not afraid of wolves, and they're dispelling some of the myths. Incidentally, they looked at the cougar carcass, came back, walked back there, and it looked like it had been killed by another cougar. And as an aside, Will, the Fish and Game has actually increased the number of allowable cougar takes in the wilderness. And it was one of the great places where they studied. Out of that area is where they studied cougars, where Maurice Hornacker started his cougar study, I believe, in the early 60s. And unfortunately, now they're killing so many of them. I think they're having some social interactions. And when you kill big males, several smaller, less fit males try to take the territory, and so they have a lot of territorial disputes. And that may actually lead to an increase in cougar predation on ungulates, and it destabilizes sort of cougar social structures.
Hmm.
And so, yes, cougars don't do as well with wolves around, but they do inhabit the same places. Yeah, there's a little bit of a competition there. From time to time, a cougar will kill a wolf, we even found out. But that's usually on individuals and the packs. They, you know, sometimes they'll be chased by packs. Reproductive success isn't as great. But those two predators are probably keeping each other sort of at some sort of a dynamic equilibrium, their numbers. And, of course, predators do that generally on their own anyway through their reproduction or lack thereof. But they're very interesting. They're keeping each other on their toes, and there you have it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And just to talk to those folks out there who think immediately when you talk about fear in wolves, that how could you possibly not fear a wolf? And maybe you do, and that's, I think there's a difference between fearing a wolf and reacting negatively, mm-hmm. Because you have that fear and mm-hmm. acting aggressively and losing your composure and making unintelligent decisions. And I think these folks probably have an innate hair or two that gets on end when they hear a wolf howl. Probably mm-hmm. most of us do.
Yeah.
And that's okay, as long as we know that behavior and thousands of years of history show that we're not going to get attacked by these wolves, mm-hmm. and it best to maintain your composure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you can get to the place where you can even relish the experience, that's a dandy place to end up.
That is a dandy place. And looking more at those interactions, cougars, wolves, and then the other ungulates, my guess is that even if elk numbers do go down, which they're not thinking they are, but if it puts, it may give a little bit of competitive advantage to two species that aren't doing as well in terms of ungulates or the large hoofed mammals as they did prior to the first European pioneers and European Americans that came to this part of the world, and that are in the Salmon River country. We're talking about bighorn sheep and mule deer, and they elk do compete against both. And perhaps now this may give us somewhat of an advantage to those species. So there you go, Will. Having maybe healthy populations of both cougars, wolves, and maybe at some point in the future the big bear, there you have it. Kind of leads to healthy populations of these other ungulates.
Yeah, and it really kind of makes a case for quality research mm-hmm. Into these ungulate populations, because they are going to be more difficult to observe mm-hmm. now that they have another natural predator, mm-hmm. another in that suite of predators that already exists. And it's going to be harder for hunters in locations where these predators exist to find their quarry, because these animals are more alert now.
That's right. Especially like I said, elk. And we may see increases in some other populations, like I said, a bighorn sheep, which tend to not do as well competitively, but which neither wolves nor cougars kill very many of simply because of their habitat choices.
Interesting. And, you know, kind of a testament to that old school naturalist biology, ecology research. Mm-hmm. And great that some of that's still happening out there.
So we can award the Elk Burger of the Week.
Echoed, wow.
To the research being done by the Aikensons.
All right.
Down at the Taylor Research Center, Wilderness Research Center, University of Idaho. Interesting place down on Big Creek. So
I have a feeling they've been eating their share of the Elk Burgers.
Elk Burgers there anyway. So there we go.
All right.
I'm sure of that as well. So there we go. Some interesting biological news. Well.
All right. Well, Gary, I think we're going to go into a quick musical break.
I think so.
And we're going to come
back.
Back.
And should we go into our peaks, new peaks section, and then finish up with our species spotlight, huh?
Sounds good.
Okay.
We'll be right back. All right. That's Built to Spill.
Local Idaho band.
Yeah. Quick Weather.
Or at least originally.
Yeah, out of Boise originally?
I believe
Boise
so.
Band? Okay, Weather Service. It's looking like it's going to be getting wet. After this evening, and increasing cloudiness this evening, going into rain tomorrow, 50% chance. And it looks like chances just increase all the way into Sunday. Our lows in the mid-30s to 40, highs 50, 51 degrees into the weekend, and then with a low, or excuse me, a high of 46 on Sunday. So kind of nasty weather out
it's,
there.
But it's warming up. Oh, I'm looking forward to the snow.
Me too.
Well, Will, let's start our new segment.
All right.
Peaks of the Clearwater.
Peaks of the Clearwater.
Yeah, we talk about a peak. It's not really a prominent peak, but it's a good one to, I think, kick it off. And it's one that many people have probably heard about or gone to. Actually, there's two of them we're going to talk a little bit about today. And these are peaks kind of in the heart of the wild Clearwater country, right on that northern edge, kind of the northwestern edge of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. They overlook the Locksaw drainage, since they are within the actual Locksaw watershed. And one of the peaks bears a name, the Locksaw Peak.
All right.
And the other, Cantaloupe Peak.
Cantaloupe. Hmm.
And that's, they overlook the Wilderness Gateway. People probably all know where that is. And they're there to the south, Wilderness Gateway. The reason I picked these peaks is it's a great time of year. The fall is a wonderful time to visit them. The trail that goes up from Wilderness Gateway goes up on the foot, or on the shoulder, I guess would be a better description, of Locksaw Peak. It doesn't go all the way to the top of Locksaw Peak. And then you can choose where you want to go. You come to a fork in the trail up there. If you continue on the same trail to the east, it goes right up over on the top of Cantaloupe Peak within the wilderness. And Cantaloupe Peak looks right down on kind of Huckleberry Creek and places like that. And Cantaloupe Peak gets up there a little bit.
Yeah.
It's about 6,100 feet in elevation, you know, over 6,000 feet. And Locksaw Peak is nearly 5,000 feet. It's about 4,900 feet in elevation. So,
and you're starting at about 2,500?
Now
at the campground, 20?
At the campground, I believe we figured out we're starting closer to 2,200 feet, even lower than Moscow, a little bit lower. Wilderness Gateway, just a bit lower. Maybe a little bit colder, though. It's in that canyon. And chose these two peaks since they're kind of in the heart of the wild Clearwater country, but also I did a little trip to them. Will and I took a little walk up there yesterday.
A little
walk in the woods. I got up on Cantaloupe Peak, and up there, an inch or two of snow. Not much, but there is a little snow up there, and great time to be out. One of the interesting things about these little creeks that drain from Cantaloupe and Locksaw Peak, these two little creeks that go right on in, one of them goes into Boulder Creek, a tributary. In fact, both of them do. One's called the West Fork, and the other's called Asparagus Creek. That's really an interesting name. You've got Cantaloupe Peak and Asparagus.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre.
Bizarre names. But the larch, the amount of larch in both those little sub-drainages and that kind of little basin area there is just amazing, beautiful. Now's the time of year. If you want to see the western larch, I talked about that last week. That was our featured, our species spotlight. Talked about the Western Larch. Wow.
Yeah, we felt like the Wizard of Oz, you know, the Yellow Brick Road. Those trails were just paved with those golden tamarack, large, excuse me.
Tamarack's also another name for us.
Those larch needles. Mm-hmm. Just nice and softened the trail a little bit for us, too, since it stayed frozen the whole day.
Yeah.
Just stayed cold enough that we couldn't sit down too long for lunch. Couldn't really sit down much at all.
No.
Kept moving.
In fact, the trails were, the boggy areas were frozen right over. The mud bogs were completely fixed, I guess, by the cold, at least for human feet. I don't know about it, a horse or something, a bit heavier. But for us, they were just fine. And that paved yellow brick road is right from all the larch needles. Beautiful time of year. Beautiful clear day. I very few, saw one or two clouds, I think, the whole day, made nice little contrast to that deep blue sky this time of year. Nice country and beautiful.
Yeah, and those, we talked about this on our hike a little bit as well. The these places in the Clearwater country has relatively low elevations compared to a lot of the mm-hmm. other places in the Northern Rockies.
That's right.
Doesn't get too high.
Doesn't get very high, and that's what we think of as alpine around here are mainly due to fires that occurred in 1910, 1934, the two big fire years. A lot of the peaks that are a little bit bare for that reason, not because they're in alpine tundra. And again, these two peaks you're talking about, both of them are forested. Cantaloupe Peak has got a little bit of cliff on part of it there. You look on that kind of that northern face and that eastern face, kind of drops off a little bit, but it has been burned up there. But right on the top, you've got trees. Trees are coming back. On the sides, you've got some elk food, ceanothus, and some of the brush. Even up at that high elevation, a relatively high elevation, 6,100 feet. So forested peaks, and they're part of that big intrusion, geologically known as the Idaho Batholith. And just stuck up there, a big magma, I guess, intrusion, and it formed a kind of rock. Most people commonly refer to it as a granite, but I believe geologists have very specific terms for granite. Depends on how it cooled and the percentages of the various minerals like feldspar and mica within the rock itself and quartz. I call it granite. Everybody else calls it granite, but I think they might have a more specific name. But these peaks are typical of the Idaho Batholith. They are granitic or igneous rocks in formation, but quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. Up there, and surprisingly, on some of those peaks, you'll find a fair amount of soil formation. It's been a while. There's a little bit of soil. They're not completely rocky, as we found out. There's a little bit of soil up there, and an interesting plant community is associated with these peaks. Again, they're not completely rocky on top.
Yeah, Cantaloupe Peak especially kind of intrigued me as we got further and further closer to the top. It just kind of opened up a little more, mm-hmm. just enough light in there to allow what seemed to be almost a complete carpet of bear grass and a couple other ground cover species. And grouse whortleberry, that's right, and lodgepole pine. Mm-hmm. Didn't start seeing that until we got a little further up.
A little further up, and as well. Up in elevation, and mm-hmm. saw larch all the way up. So our two peaks in our peak segment today, Cantaloupe Peak and Loxa Peak.
Yeah, and we saw some interesting species as well, and maybe we can comment on those for a few minutes, Gary. And,
mm-hmm.
It's that time of year when a lot of animals have two-legged predators that they don't usually have, but mm-hmm. we saw quite a few spruce grouse, the mm-hmm. Franklin subspecies.
Right.
Of the spruce grouse. And one sure way to know, or at least in my opinion, my humble opinion, experience, if you're not sure what kind of grouse you've seen in this area, the Franklin's grouse are a lot more chocolatey, chestnut brown than they are black. And if you've been into the upper Midwest or Canada, a lot of spruce grouse there are really dark colored. These almost always, though, spruce grouse will stay close by. They call them the fool's hen.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of other northern species or island species, this bird is not too concerned about the presence of humans.
No,
and that's probably because of thousands of years of lack of human presence on many isolated islands, and in this case in more northern climes. Not that they're tame or stupid, but that just what they've, I guess it's been built into their genes to not react
mm-hmm.
and fly away immediately. And so we saw quite a few Franklin's grouse on the walk up there.
Yeah, good inhabitants of the two peaks here, Frank's grouse.
Yeah,
saw a couple of other hangers on. I thought, and maybe they will migrate. I don't know. Well, because it's my understanding they do move a little bit, but indicative of some more forests couple of very beautiful birds and members of the same family as robins. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We did. We saw some varied thrushes.
Varied thrushes.
Family Turdidae.
Mm-hmm.
And the thrushes, also bluebirds are in that family. And they'll stick around. The varied thrushes will stay around. If you live in Moscow or I don't know if you see them in Pullman as much, but in Moscow, there's quite a few cedars in town, and they'll come down from Moscow Mountain and hang out in your yard. I know they'll come and hang out down there in Troy, too.
Yeah, we've seen them in this, and they tend to leave us in the winter, though, and head a little lower, maybe. And they may end up in Moscow, maybe in some cedar groves, I guess.
Yeah.
Perhaps at the lower elevation. But we saw one of them fairly high, I guess, and they're probably going to start heading down.
That's right. And also saw a pileated woodpecker. Right before we left and headed out for the day, we saw a pileated just gave his resounding call as we were walking right next to him. And got a nice look at that largest member, or second largest member of the woodpecker family now that the ivory billed has been
rediscovered. Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting species. That we saw, and one of them we're going to feature.
That's right. We not only saw species in the flesh, but we also saw signs of species.
We, of course, saw the obvious sign of the ungulates. You see up there, elk. Quite a few elk tracks.
Yep.
And, of course, they're not going to be our featured species this week, but quite a few of those, some mammals. Saw some other mammal tracks. Saw the squirrels, tree squirrels, and, again, the native one. We see around here. What's the species on that?
Richardson's. And they call it a pine or tree squirrel.
Pine or tree squirrel. Yeah. Douglas. I've heard Douglas fir tree squirrel referred to. You know.
Yeah, the chicory. They have all kinds of names. Yeah. All kinds of common names for those guys.
Yeah.
But it was a Halloween hike, there was quite a bit of wildlife to be seen there on Loxa and Cantaloupe Peak, and. If you have the chance, this is a great time of year to hike it. As you may know, those cold temperatures somehow seem to quiet the woods down a bit, just as they do right after a big snowfall. It was very quiet and good time to observe natural processes and natural creatures doing their thing. So
there we have our two peaks for the week, Cantaloupe and Loxaw.
All right.
So, Will?
Well, I think we're going to get into one more musical break here, Gary. I'm going to let Gary hand me...
I'm going to hand him a CD and have him play the first song.
Why don't you give some background
here,
Gary?
We're not doing much of a shift here. We played a little Built to Spill, and so, again, some more alternative. Play maybe number one. This is perhaps one of the more famous bands of the more alternative rock and roll movement, or punk movement, Sonic Youth. You keep me coming.
All right. Back on the wild Clearwater Country. Now, Sonic Youth, someone's calling in. Maybe they'll pick up your call in the office, or if you'll try again right at the end of the show, we'd be glad to hear from you. Maybe you've seen this creature we're about to talk about. We saw their tracks.
Yeah, we did. We did, Will.
Quite a few
of them. Nice set. Member of the weasel family.
That's
Mustelidae.
Right.
Very, very rare creature. We've talked about some of them before on the show, these rare weasels. And there are three that are considered sort of the part of the forest carnivores. And there are two that are considered particularly rare. And both have been petitioned for endangered status. One, of course, the very famous wolverine. But that's not what we saw. This animal's a little bit smaller than a wolverine. And the tracks were not the huge wolf-sized tracks. This was pretty good, though. This is bigger, a little bit bigger than a coyote track, I would say. And it's a fissure. Martz penanti, I guess I'm trying to pronounce the Latin name. Very closely related to the pine marten. And these tracks, I think, were a little too big for a pine marten, judging from the size and the distance between the straddle, the front and back track, that 4.5 inches between the when they straddle on the back, the feet where they didn't come together, but when they had that straddle, it was closer to what I thought 6 inches on that back straddle is my recollection. Well, it was about it was fairly wide. It wasn't very, very narrow.
Yeah, an interesting kind of pattern to their gallop there too. Their front 2 feet. Just by looking at the tracks there on the snow, it seemed I've never seen a fissure in the wild, so I'm just speculating. But to their gallop, their front 2 prints were fairly close together, but not overlapping. Mm-hmm. You could see them distinctly separate from each other. And their back 2 were kind of a little bit overlapping, mm-hmm. and then to the side.
Yeah.
So it looked as if they pushed off, and then brought their back feet up forward. Mm-hmm. And landed right behind where their front feet took mm-hmm. off from. Yeah.
Very interesting pattern.
Bounding or loping along there in pretty good-sized leaps.
And one of the interesting things about the tracks of this species of fissure is that they sometimes will register the 5 toes. And they kind of they don't have that symmetry that you see in a cat track or a dog track. They tend to be a little more asymmetrical. The mustelids, you have that, sometimes that 5th toe will show up. So I think that's pretty as interesting. We saw that in a couple of instances, that kind of sideways, very, in kind of an odd, kind of more like a human handprint sort of a mm-hmm. thing than that more symmetrical print that we're used to seeing with typical canids or felids.
Yeah, fissures, one of those kind of rare forest carnivores that the Wild Clearwater Country is such an important place for, and as many of you know, we've probably said before, this Wild Clearwater Country, this northern half of the big wild, northern half of the biggest intact ecosystem of Lower 48, has been noted by some pretty darn good ecologists and biologists to be the most important area in the Northern Rockies for carnivores, including these ones we're talking about today.
And this, in fact, is considered the most important area for carnivores. And this is perhaps here is the center. The Wild Clearwater Country is the center of fissure distribution in the state of Idaho.
Okay.
It really is. And I think that we probably ought to give a little history of how fissures got...
Yeah, they have an interesting history here.
Interesting. They're, the difference between fissures and pine martens is... evolutionarily they probably came from the same the same parent species, but they've actually differentiated. In fact, pine martens, a couple of different of they have 2 very different subspecies, but they did differentiate, fissures being a much larger. And in Idaho, it was thought, though although not confirmed, that because of habitat loss and trapping, and a lot of that loss was due to what they thought were fires, since they like older trees in the early 1900s. I don't know if that's ever been confirmed, that they were no longer found in Idaho. So they did some reintroduction, I believe, was it in the 1960s, Will, in the state of Idaho. But they found out that
1960s.
Fishers have come back. And, in fact, one of the more definitive studies about Fisher was done in the South Fork of the Clearwater on the Nez Perce National Forest by Jones. And that was done in the early 1990s, one of the best populations, the most studied populations in the lower 48, sort of a center for Fisher activity. So that's some of the history in the background of the Fisher in Idaho, a member of the weasel family. Of course, they are a carnivore. And interestingly enough, they're considered one of the few effective predators of porcupines.
Mm, that's right. That's right. I remember hearing that too. Not much was known about this creature until the 30s or 40s, and they're realizing then that there were very few, if any, of these fishers in Idaho at all. In fact, the kind of the seminal work for mammals in Idaho, The Recent Mammals of Idaho by William Davis, came out in 1939. They had virtually no information about fishers whatsoever, except to say that an individual had trapped one in the Ketchum area, a single individual, and that they'd heard reports of others being seen and thought that they would be more common in the central wildlands of Idaho.
And once they found a little more about this creature, some more studies came out, found out that it is rather rare, but they are now protected in Idaho, although quite a few are taken in incidental traps set for pine marten, and you'll find, especially in Lolo Pass up here, that you'll find a fisher taken in traps and are often killed in pine marten traps, although I don't know that trapping is all that common anymore. But there are several fishers, I think, each year that are trapped up there.
Yeah, still legal in Montana.
Still
they
legal,
can trap,
I believe,
everything there, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're still legal in Montana. Not in Idaho, although I'm not sure that trappers are required, if they do trap one, to bring them in. And I don't know if they are allowed to keep that after that. Mm. You know, it's kind of here in the state of Idaho.
Yeah, they're interesting. They're kind of in between a squirrel and a wolverine in size. 15, 17 pounds is a good-sized male. And they're extremely sexually dimorphic, meaning that there's a large difference in size between male and female. Females are generally half the weight of the males, rather slight.
Mm-hmm. Now, the tracks we saw might have been a female. You know, well, I don't know. They were large, but I don't know that they were as big as the maybe a full-grown male would have been. That's very interesting.
Yeah. So they were reintroduced in north central Idaho in the 1960s. And some folks speculate, and that's all that I've found, speculation of why their habitat, why their populations decreased. Some folks think that trapping had a lot to do with it. Some folks think that habitat change, including the big fires in 1910, 1934, might have had an impact on fishers. And that fire over the school fire this past year kind of brought to my attention something I hadn't really considered, the effect of large scale wildfire on wildlife populations before. Mm-hmm. They can have a pretty significant impact on a local population.
They can on local areas. Mm-hmm. Although we need to recognize large scale wildfires have been a part of the Clearwater country since time immemorial, and fishers were here when the first European Americans arrived. So we do know that they can survive fires. But what's interesting, that some of the more recent declines, I think, are more keyed into some of the habitat loss through logging. In Idaho, the research shows that they're very, especially in the summer, I believe, are extremely dependent on mature our old growth habitat. Somewhat less so in the winter, but they still think that in the summer in particular, they tend to key in on that old growth habitat, and also the kind of the riparian habitat. So that's where you find a lot of the fissure.
Hmm. A little bit of history about taxonomy. Mm-hmm. And as many current situations in animal taxonomy, the jury is always out, and the jury's still out on fissures. But folks do think they, most people believe that, or most biologists studying this believe that fissures are kind of uniform, though there were three subspecies proposed back in the 60s, being an eastern subspecies, a Rocky Mountain subspecies, and a Pacific Coast subspecies. And ours would have been the MP Columbiana, the Rocky Mountain region, but subsequent analyses of morphological characteristics have shown that they don't think that subspecies are distinct enough to warrant a distinction between the individuals, even though there's pretty solid habitat separation, geological or geographical separation between those three populations. They seem to be fairly similar.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at an animal that's about 15 pounds at most.
Mm-hmm.
For the big males, probably half that. Let's say for the females, 6, 7, 8 pounds. That's about the size of a cat. But when you actually look at them, they puff up, and they look much larger. They look like a great big cat. And they had that dark, lustrous dark fur. I've only seen one, and it was like seeing a great big black cat, except their face is more pointed. They have a different, you know, the snout. It's a little, you know, it's a weasel snout rather than a cat snout, and quite the critter. The reproduction is also very, very interesting. They only reproduce annually with one litter. And on the research they've conducted, they generally breed in March and April. But like some of the other weasels, they have delayed implantation.
Mm-hmm.
And the length of gestation is only about 35 days. Amazing.
That's amazing for a mammal.
For a mammal. A very short gestation. And that one of the, you know, they tend to be like other large forest carnivores. They tend to be a slow reproducer. And again, one litter and per year. And many times this delayed implantation, if the circumstances aren't favorable for fissures, then pregnancy won't occur. And I think that's, you know, they only produce one litter a year, if that. You know, they, and if the conditions aren't right, if there's not enough food for them, then they're not going to have young.
It's also interesting to note that fissures are only found in North America. Unlike a lot of other mammal species or other species at this latitude that can be circumpolar, found in similar latitudes in Asia and Europe. Fissures are primarily North American and found up to 60 degrees latitude, well up into Canada.
Well up into Canada.
Northern, a creature of the northern forests.
Yeah, northern boreal forests, and yeah. We're lucky to have them here.
We are.
Down into the state of Idaho, and quite the animal. One to six in their litters. Again, not a lot, and...
And that's a good. It's a good time of year to get out and hike some peaks in the Clearwater and look for some mammal tracks.
If you get mammal tracks,
get up high enough,
everyone to.
Yeah, you're going to see some of those. You're going to see some of those tracks in the snow, and take some time, get to know them this winter. Spend some time studying. See what maybe you can even weave a story. See what happened there on the trail in front of you the night before. And I kind of like to do that and think about this fisher chasing. We saw some small rabbit tracks, probably cottontails, not big enough for a snowshoe hare. And that fisher could have been chasing a couple cottontails down Cantaloupe Peak just that evening before, looking for a meal. And a few tracks of pine squirrels as well seen there. And, of course, the tracks on the trail were dominated by those of our ungulate friends, the elk, which we did see on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't see on the trail, but did see a few elk on the hillside there near Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
As we came home,
and a bald eagle down on the river as well.
That's right.
But like I said, fishers, carnivores, they subsist mainly on small to medium-sized prey. They eat birds, interesting. I bet the grouse is probably something they try to ambush. But they'll readily eat carrion, you know, and that way they're sort of like the wolverine. And this is one thing that's very interesting about the two very closely related kind of forest weasels, I guess. It'd be a good word for them, the Fisher and Pine Martens, is they like fruit. In fact, the way some people trap pine martens is they put jam out for them.
Wow.
They love strawberries. Strawberry jam. I don't know why.
Wow.
But fishers, their diet includes things like snowshoe hares, same as lynx, porcupines, as we mentioned, one of only two critters that are known to prey much on porcupines. And the fisher might even be better. They tend to get, they're so agile, they can get under the porcupine and attack them. Fishers and cougars, sometimes cougars will put their paws underneath and try to flip them over, porcupines. But, of course, mice, voles, shrews, moles, squirrels, birds, and even mushrooms.
All right. Interesting. That's interesting, Gary. Mm-hmm. We did see some strangely placed mushrooms along the trail, including a couple kind of dangling precipitously or precariously in a fir tree above us as we walked along.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And the way they attack, the last little bit about fishers on their eating habits, the way they attack porcupines, they try to get under them and attack their unprotected face. And it's the only species that attacks a porcupine in that way. Of course, hardly anything attacks a porcupine, but because they're agile enough to avoid tail swipes of the porcupine. Amazing. Wow.
When the rats run riot and the screen door slams, when the trees grow quiet, nothing but cats and cans. When the breeze says try it, but you can't hardly see, when your love has died.